I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Early Childhood and Family Supports for Thursday, February 16th to order. Remind members, there's several things in the works that might end up being committee bills, but we're still open to do that. And I wanted to call to your attention, I know you all received the follow-up report from OHA, the statistics in that they provided, and just express my appreciation to Kate and the people for providing that. That was great information, follow-up to our meeting. So today we have two informational meetings. So I'm going to open the first informational meeting on relief nurseries. And I'm going to call Tim Rusk, Pedro Gomez, Judge Ann Aiken, and Sam Barber to the front, please. And if each, when you speak, would just introduce yourself for the record, we'd appreciate that.
Perfect. Chairperson Lively and committee members, my name is Tim Rusk. I'm Executive Director of Mountain Star Family Relief Nursery. Just appreciate the opportunity to come and talk about the Relief Nursery Program. We'll kind of work our way down the line here, but I'll kick it off to talk a bit about relief nurseries in general. And I know some.
Hi, Tim.
How are you? Thanks for
he
being here.
He does that all the time. So.
I know some of you are very familiar with relief nurseries, so I want to move pretty quickly. But at the same time, if you have questions or that kind of thing, I want to be open for that. So just a word about me personally. So I've been at the relief nursery there in Bend for 15 years. And when I started, we had 34 children in our program, and we were part of the Educational Service District. So it was great to be part of the relief nursery model, but it was a little bit like being in a nice car stuck in the parking lot. So that idea of becoming an independent nonprofit and really engaging deeply with the community and doing the fundraising was a key part to our success. So 15 years later, we don't have 34 children a year. We have 350 that we work with, and we're a tri-county program, including Madras and Prineville, and starting a program in the La Pine. So that's a key part of the relief nursery model. So just one other word about me personally. So I also had the privilege of co-chairing a committee to look at child well-being measures between early childhood and the child wellness and the health world. So personally, I'm pretty committed to relief nurseries and leveraging community funds in order to deliver high-quality services, which is, you know, I wanted to let you know I have skin in the game. But more so that each relief nursery has somebody like me driving their program and trying to leverage every opportunity and, again, create high-quality services for the program. So if I could have the next slide. The whole concept of relief nurseries, you may know, came from Lane County 40 years ago with that idea that, you know, isn't there a better way to support children and families that are living with multiple issues and multiple problems? So from that inspiration of, you know, can't we do things better? Isn't there a way to step in and prevent services? It created the Relief Nursery Program 40 years later. And certainly now, more than ever, we know parenting is really tough. Fortunately, my kids are 23 and 25, so that's just on the brink of grandparent, I guess. But I'll never forget the challenges of being a parent for young children. It's extremely challenging. And when you add on that risk factors and other complicating issues, it's a big issue. So ultimately, you probably know 48% of all child abuse victims are children 5 and under. So it's an incredibly vulnerable age. And with what we've learned now about brain science and the importance of attachment, the concept of this committee, but also of relief nurseries, is just profoundly important. And just the one other note, these days, raise, in particular, the status of child welfare system certainly comes to my mind frequently. It's challenging that that system works hard to achieve what they can and at the same time have failed their federal audit. So again, it reemphasizes the need for a prevention-based program. So the Relief Nursery Services, the heart of it, you can see in the handout, is really that therapeutic early childhood classroom and program. So when you go visit a Relief Nursery, you see these beautiful classrooms, very high adult to child ratio. It really is operated through that therapeutic intent. It's not just child care or early learning. It's a real focus on the fact that children in the program have lived with a lot of trauma, potentially toxic stress or traumatic stress, that kind of thing. So the way we work with children is really different. So altogether, when you look at the classroom, the home visiting, parent education, all of that wraps into about 300 hours per year annually. So it's a pretty significant impact. If you think about 300 hours of therapy, that's a lot of therapy. And it really makes a difference. But this also sort of identifies our niche. We're not trying to be a Head Start program. We're not trying to do all-day daycare or something like that, or early childhood education. It's a really focused intervention. Was there a question? So in addition to the therapeutic classroom, kind of the first way into the program is through the outreach program. So that's an initial assessment and evaluation, and families are sort of triaged into either the therapeutic early childhood program, or they can stay in that outreach program.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Huffman.
You did kind of give me an opening, Tim.
Sorry, Tim.
Thank you for that.
That's right. You inhaled.
I think I wanted to put a finer point on this to give you the chance to clarify. You feel that the relief nurseries are performing a service that is not being replicated with other agencies.
Correct.
Okay.
Profoundly, yes.
I want to make that point.
Profoundly, yes.
As you and Judge Aiken both talk, I'd like for you to talk about where we've come with relief nurseries, because we've come a long way, but we're with early learning, early childhood, we're in kind of a new arena, and I personally want to make sure relief nurseries don't get lost or, God forbid, done away with or whatever, and I'd like for both of you to comment in your testimony about if you see some things coming you're concerned about, please be open and honest with us so we can help address those. And
yeah, Representative Huffman, thank you. I think it is a unique niche, and that therapeutic classroom environment is certainly a key part of it. We have a 3-to-1 adult-to-child ratio, so it enables us to do something really unique in the classroom in terms of attachment and adult attention. When you combine that with what's going on with the home visit, I think home visiting programs, I'm all in favor of them, but this combination of doing both classroom-based services and the home visits allows us to build rapport and trust with families. So there's nothing like a family facing many, many risk factors kind of out on their own. But if they can partner with the relief nursery, I think then there's some hope and some idea of progress and that kind of thing. So just to round off this slide, so go ahead.
Representative Hack, sorry.
Thank you, Chair Lively. I'm going to hop in with what Rep. Huffman said, because I think it's so important that you really take the time today to let us know what you do different than everybody else and why you are so, so important to what work needs to be done in early childhood. And I think it's so important that we stress that, because not everybody understands what a relief nursery does and the impacts that they have and why it is so unique. So I just don't want to see us get lost in the fluff of, I don't know how else to say it, but somebody out of the four of you has to be able to articulate to us.
I'm going to take that right now.
Okay.
Because I have longer history, frankly, than any of these folks. Since 1988,
Ann
Aiken,
thank you.
U.S. District Court for Oregon. I served as a family law attorney for 10 years on the Oregon Lane County Circuit Court, 2 years of those 10 years as a juvenile judge, and I've served 19 years on the federal bench. I have been a member of the Relief Nursery Board and the expansion of the Relief Nursery since 1988, and I can't say enough incredible things about having had that as a resource. And the tremendous pride in the numbers of nursery that have grown, because my goal, and the goal of many of us, because it's an entourage of people who are just tired of failure and seeing kids, our most precious resource, damaged. And they could only go into the system if they were damaged, neglected, or something worse. And so that was really done as a public-private partnership, because government's not that nimble, and you have to be nimble to respond to the acute needs. So this is really, in lots of respects, a very sophisticated medical model to address the needs of complex kids and families using risk, needs, responsivity, and making the services available to the unique family. So I'm going to tell you, it goes back to the nurseries operating when Lynn Frohnmeyer and Mary Ellen Eiler decided they were child protection service workers, and they could not abide the fact that they couldn't do anything until the children were badly hurt or neglected. So they worked with the Junior League to work to put something different so that you didn't have to wait. And when parents needed help, they had a place to go that was comprehensive and at the same time a service delivery model that met the individual needs. And you need to understand this dovetails with, I know a number of you are in law enforcement, it dovetails with the risk need responsivity we're using in corrections now. And in so many ways, I have brought 50 to 60 different U.S. District Court districts, including U.S. attorneys, to Oregon to see about our reentry program, people coming out of prisons. And we started the Relief Nursery because our model was designed in both ends, the highest risk offenders coming out of prison and the highest risk kids and families up front, to provide comprehensive services and services targeted to what they need, and to build a rapport and a relationship. So when it was started, and I can tell you I was back in the days when we were in three different churches and an administrative office somewhere else, and the families were incredibly high risk. And we had risk of faculty and staff harm because the families were so difficult. And where I was, where I got involved is I went on the bench, and I'd done family law for a long time, and I started seeing people hitting their kids in the courtroom. I saw the parents acting in ways that were just crazy, and I thought to myself, you know, if I were sentencing myself, I had five kids, I had a job and a family home, and I had a car. But I couldn't have done what I was sentencing myself, these people to do, especially, for example, in a DUII sentence. So we had to figure out how to do services that were user-friendly, not agency-easy. And that, you'll hear that from me, user-friendly. Remember who we're serving all the time. Ask them what we need. Find out what their barriers are. It's not about us. It's not about agency-easy. Meet them more than halfway where they are. And so when I started trying to get people into the nursery, I would have to call the executive director, who is a genius and one of my favorite people in the entire world, Jean Phelps, because she speaks truth to power. And she said, well, where's your money? And I said, well, I'm going to have to go get some money, or I'm going to have to help you raise the money, because it's a public-private partnership and it's raised in the community because the community cares. And so over time, within not very long, I ended up on the building committee to build a building, because that's what we needed to do, because I told her we needed to build capacity. So I'm here because we need to build capacity. The kids in our state deserve an infrastructure of services specified for their needs and their family dynamics and those criminogenic needs, to address them in the most sophisticated way and nimbly, depending on what community you're in, and building on the strengths of that community. So I got on the building committee, and it was a terrible, terrible economic time, and yet we had people meeting every single week for 18 months to get our first building. And it was built in a very difficult time. It was built by the community, and we were told that with the feasibility study, we couldn't do it. 5 years, maybe we'll get it done. We said we need it now, and basically a bunch of community people just said we're not going to stand for it. And in 18 months, we raised $2.2 million in a depressed economy and built the building. And that's where we started. I'm from here. I'm a second generation Oregonian. I read all about all you guys, and it's amazing how many of us ended up in caring about government and public policy. But I was so excited when Salem came down to take a look at it, because I grew up next to the prisons. I did projects with the Lifers Club. I know the needs in this community. So we have spent, a number of us, an army of us, have spent years going community to community to say, this is your community's solution, and this is your community's problem, and here's how we can help. And what's unique about the Relief Nursery is it's built on
evidence-based practices, components that are necessary to be in place to do the kind of work that gives an outcome data for a particular family that we can measure. And one of the things about being in a public-private partnership organization, not funded by any one source and being a mosaic, is you have to keep so much data. It's unbelievable how much data is demanded of either the federal government, the state government. Actually, the grants demand a great deal of the local communities. And so we have to constantly keep data. And I, interestingly, happen to be a huge data wonk. And so it's been really important to me that we fund the strategies that make a difference, because so many times in corrections and in sometimes in these early intervention programs, we do not look at the data. And we do not take a look at what's working and what's not working. And what the nursery has always been willing to do is take a look at how can we do it better. How can we address a problem, for example, in Bend that's different from a problem in Medford, that's different from a problem in Albany, that's different from a problem in Pendleton, different from a problem in Madras, and different from Salem or Eugene. And then there's Portland. The problems are really great with kids and families. And I'm sorry to jump right in, but I had three sentencings this week. If you don't understand the job of a judge, it's what I'm dealing with is the failure of these systems. I say this every day. I've said it four times this week. Child abuse and neglect explains 90% of the people standing in front of me. It does not excuse the behavior, but it is not a rocket science obligation to understand that all this leads to the criminal justice system. So I want to share with you, and I'll give you a copy of it, but there's an article in the Oregonian this week on a sentencing I did in Portland of a tribal member. It ends up in federal court because of the sovereignty of the tribe. And it was a 10-year-old boy who had been sexually assaulted by his uncle, 10. And the uncle, the story of the family was replete with child abuse and neglect, and the uncle had been badly damaged. So I'm going to tell you the problems we see every day in the federal court, in the state court, in adult court, all stems from not having the best services and the best opportunity to be strategic with limited resources, whether it's making sure they have food, transportation, getting them out of domestic violence situations, providing a therapeutic preschool the beauty of that is that we can identify and work therapeutically with kids without labeling them, so that when they go to school, we have the best chance of transitioning them using the best brain research out there and being nimble enough to adapt. The neurosciences, I'm very involved with the law and neuroscience aspects of behavioral change, and that it's happening so fast that what we're able to do at the nursery is wind in those evidence-based strategies and do it quickly. So the other case I want to, I asked permission from both of these other gentlemen. Stephen Matthew Chambers, what's remarkable is when I sentenced him, everybody in the room, I mean, this is his file. I sentenced him to St. Mary's at age 14, shackled, out of control, screaming. That's how he was sent to St. Mary's. And they said, what do you remember about him? And I said, I remember a lot about him, because I rarely had the chance to send anybody to St. Mary's to a therapeutic preschool. And by the time he was 14, he was badly, badly damaged. So here he is in front of me at 33. We had a very interesting dialogue. We can't wait. We're waiting way too long to address these issues, way too long. I've sat on the Governor's Commission on Juvenile Offenders and Juvenile Projects. That's when we ended up in the years of building juvenile jails to prove we were tough, which was really a bad strategy. Mm-hmm. I was on the side of getting kids dealing with dependency cases, and they said, we'll do that later. I've been on the Governor's Commission on Pregnant Substance Abusers. If we'd implemented some of those strategies back then, we wouldn't have some of the issues we had. But it was, again, you had to be a change agent. You had to do something different. The kids and families' issues are better than their long-term. They're better than 2, 4, and 6 years. And you know what I mean when I say those terms. It's been since 1988. I am as highly charged, as energetic, as committed as ever because of what I see every day in the courtrooms and what people tell me and what the difference it makes for these kids. So why is it unique? It's unique because it's a public-private partnership. It makes the community come together to solve the problem when we don't have enough money. We have a terrible budget problem this year. I read and watch everything. And what you have to do is empower the communities to come together. I think as a member of Eugene and most recently our building of the Springfield, I practice a lot in Springfield. I couldn't be prouder of what we've done because it's brought the communities together to help solve some of these issues. and fathers who want to do a better job. But, you know, to be honest, most of the folks that we serve and many of the people I see in the criminal justice field, they just never had a clue. They just don't know what they don't know. And so the last thing I would tell you is one of the interesting things about the nursery model, and it needs to be in the statute, it needs to be protected, that needs to be a concept that's not just we can let it slide. And I say that with some knowledge because I sat for 8 years on the National Children's Alliance, which is the national board that governs the child abuse, child advocacy centers nationally. And they went through the similar process that you're going to go through in the state to set up criteria and responsibilities and protocols so that every child advocacy center across the country, when you do a medical exam and you do an interview, they're by the book, you know what they have to have. I mean, you can have other features of the program, but there are core principles that need to be in place to be designated a child advocacy center. That's what the relief nursery needs in this legislation. It needs to have that designation, and it needs the ability to be nimble and act on, in the communities, act on up-and-coming research and development, which I believe in the next few decades we will be much more driven by the neurosciences and the technology, the use of technology to change behavior. So I apologize for just jumping in. I just feel so committed to this because what I deal with every day is I spend my work day, except for Monday when I have this one case, I spend my work day repairing damaged adults. I spend all my free time with the nursery on trying to grow healthy children. And that's my commitment. I care about this state, and I think Oregon can be really a leader and a legacy of leaving early intervention programs for kids of abuse and neglect, unlike anybody else in the country. So I want to finish by saying one of my favorite opportunities, again, is the probation office makes me take people when they visit Oregon. They make me start at the relief nursery to give people a visual of what's possible when the community buys into what you're doing. Give me incredible opportunities to make a difference. So those attorneys across the country have come out to take a look at this as a criminal justice strategy and to look at the nurseries. And I feel privileged to be here at the request of the Association of Relief Nurseries because it's an amalgam of amazingly gifted, talented people all caring and rowing the same way. But Mary Ellen Glenn, who's here, her husband was the acting U.S. attorney, and he brought five or six U.S. attorneys from around the country. And as much as they were interested in my program, what they really were interested in was the relief nursery and how to take it back to Georgia, to South Carolina, to Virginia, to California, and what could we do to transport it. So I think this is something you all should be incredibly proud of. And I was so thrilled that the speaker set up a special committee and would take this head on. Because all the issues flow from not doing the best work we can do with children 0 to 6.
Thank you, Judge.
Hope that answered your question.
I think it did.
Can I comment?
Yes, you can.
Thank you for giving me that opportunity, Chair. First of all, I want to say thank you for the many, many years that you have dedicated your life and time away from your own family to do this work. I know you don't know me, but I'm an advocate of the work that you do. And an advocate of the relief nurseries, and I just wanted so badly for people to understand the importance and the need for the relief nurseries to continue to have their own lane,
mm-hmm. their own
and
lane.
Not get sucked into the mainstream of everything else. So I didn't mean to interrupt where you were at, and I appreciate what you do too. We needed to hear the passion that you just did.
I was just
thank
so afraid
you'd
all get up and leave. I was chief clerk here, and I've worked in about five or six different sessions. So I kind of know how you
Oh, you know how that works.
Yeah,
and
you get it.
I know it's supposed to be a dialogue. I'm here. I've got a million different ways in which we can do some things. I want you to run hard with this, mm-hmm. and I've so appreciated all over the years. Jackie Winter has been, I mean, we've just had, you know, this is like a go home stretch.
Jackie's my senator.
Yeah, I know.
Can I ask a question?
I know all of your kids.
Okay. I do have a question that I am curious about as far as in the lane issue. Yeah. And as we do our work here and we work with the early learning division, trying to understand who fits where and what's best for everybody. Have you been satisfied? Is the early learning division the best possible place for you all to be?
No.
That's something that I've been trying to, over the years, kind of wrap my head around. Why are you here? Is this the best place for you? Are we? And I'm not, I have no idea. But this is the place that I think we need to begin to have some of those tough conversations about where is the best. And we just have a responsibility to take care of the work that you do. And I don't know what that looks like. And I don't mean to throw a piece of dynamite out there, but I'm just going to be real about it, and I think we just need to have some of these conversations. So
and then I want to hear, and that was part of my question, is there nervousness on the part of relief nurseries about where you're placed, where do you need to be? Because I've been an advocate for a long time. You and I have been together doing hearings, and Tim and I have been together doing fundraisers, and I want to make sure that the work progresses the way that we want it to, without interference, but be in the right place.
I think the challenge is there's not a single best place. If the more independent we could be, to some degree, it's better. We operate really differently. We have been self-governing. So to a large degree, we've grown a system. If you look through the PowerPoint, you can see a map of 31 different programs across the state. So we've never had a dedicated staff person 100% focused to grow the relief nursery system. So it's been self-grown. It's been funded. The idea is grow first, and then the state funding comes. We don't have a mandate from ORN to move. So we've had lots of discussions. We've had the same question you have. When I consider the outcomes to our program, and there is a chart on outcomes, it is 100% around child abuse prevention. I mean, that is the flag we run up the flagpole, is around child abuse prevention. We reduce the incidence of abuse by 70%, which is pretty extraordinary given the number of risk factors family have. The other side is that operationally, a lot of what we do is early childhood work. So when you go to our classroom, they're certified by the Early Learning Division. We run high-quality early learning systems. Go ahead.
I'm not an executive director who's a member of the ONARs, but I've looked at this for a long time. To be honest, as difficult as the situation is right now, DHS actually makes enormous sense with carve-outs of what it has to be as a part of the component of DHS services to grow it, and or there's through the victims VOA program is another really strong place for it, because we're dealing again with victims. The difficulty is that everybody, what they think they can put a nursery up in, and then it kind of slides over to be more daycare-ish and not have the components. You have to have somebody or have enough independence to keep those components with integrity. Now, the National Children's Alliance, that is a separate organization. They have criteria, and of course, independence always makes a great deal of sense, but it's gonna have to be collaborative, and we always have been collaborative with DHS, because our program has been a last chance place for a lot of parents and children to come back together. Kids who have been in foster care and then are brought back in through the nursery process as possible reuniting. But it makes better sense probably looking at DHS. It'll get complicated with the early learning centers, because the hubs are more about moving people out. And I get very worried that those components are going to get piecemealed off, when the beauty of this program is it reflects the local politics. It also holds on to the core standard protocols, but allows the communities to respond. My example would be, you know, we've done this, I've been on too many statewide things where we think we can do everything statewide and juvenile stuff, and then you have like a pregnancy epidemic in, say, Klamath Falls. But then do we have to go to the state to get that addressed? Do we have some nimbility to deal with that issue that's local? So core principles that are in the statute that require that this is what it looks like, and then the flexibility, because it's a public-private partnership and money can be raised both inside and outside. And you want that. You want the community buy-in, because again, it's a big problem. Child abuse and neglect is a huge problem, and you've got to have that flexibility. You can't wait for legislative sessions or funding sources. Here, you've got to empower the community to act. So it's a hybrid, but I think it better is aligned with DHS.
Okay. Where are we at?
Perfect. That sounds good. So I really want to make sure that we get a speaker who really has experienced our services. So I'm an administrator. And Pedro, we would love to hear from you as someone who has direct experience. So.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Pedro Gomez. I'm proud to speak in front of you today to share a little of my story on how family building blocks has made me a better father and a better person. My childhood was very hard at times. My parents worked all the time and they were never home. As a child, I was given too much freedom, which led me down some wrong paths. I was abused by a babysitter when I was a young boy, and I blamed my parents. I felt they could have protected me better. My dad expected me to be macho and to be the man of the house. I was never good enough in my father's eyes. I joined a gang when I was 12 because I was looking for an escape, a place to belong, a place to feel loved. It didn't last long. Gang life wasn't for me. Too many rules. I had my first child at 15. I was terrified of being a teen dad. I really had no idea what I was doing. I eventually moved to Salem from Colorado, and my grandma introduced me to family building blocks. By then, I had four children and was a single father. When I was a struggling single dad, family building blocks was there for me. They gave me diapers, clothes, food, and helped me connect with transportation and other resources. For a very brief moment, time in those early years, my children were removed from my care when I relapsed and started doing drugs. Family building blocks was the first call I made when my children got taken away. They were there for me. They provided supervised visits to my children and helped me regain custody. They helped me realize that I was all my children had, that it was up to me to provide them with a better childhood than I had, to break the cycle. I have seven children total who have all been in family building block services for a period of time. Many have benefited from the classroom, including my youngest, Gianni. He's the smiling one in the photo. The classrooms have helped with my children's development. They've also taught me and my wife, Kim, techniques we use at home. We've learned to establish routines. We've also learned not to yell at our children and instead to teach positive reinforcement. Instead of saying, do not jump on the couch, I say, the couch is for sitting, or you can't sit on the couch. Excuse me. I've also learned to read emotions and learn what my kids need and when. When one of them is upset, maybe they've stubbed their toe on the chair and say, that must hurt, let me give you a hug. When in the past I would have said, shake it off, get over it, stop crying. Rough things my dad used to tell me. I was asked recently, what would your life look like if you have never met family building blocks? I can honestly say, if it wasn't for family building blocks, I would not have my children living with me today. Family building blocks always believed in me. Never once have I felt I was being judged. In fact, my first family building blocks home visitor told me nearly 10 years ago, one day you'll have a story to share with the community. You'll be a role model. And look where I am today, at our beautiful state capitol. What a journey this has been. I'm in a good place today. I'm a supportive husband. My children love me. I have a job and providing for my family. In fact, many of the things I've learned at Family Building Blocks I use at my job. I tell my coworkers and crew when they are doing good jobs and offer encouragement, kindness, and humor go a long way in getting the job done. And I give back. I'm a member of the Parent Leadership Council. It's a place where parents can share the struggles we are going through and offer advice to each other and to family building blocks. I encourage other dads to get involved in their kids' lives. I'm always talking about family building blocks in the community. I know it's hard to ask for help, but parents need to know family building blocks is there for them and there to help. So you've been there for me and my family, and they will be there for you when these are struggling. I want my children to learn from my experiences because of the support of our family has received. I know Gianni and his siblings can do anything they want in this world. Thank you for supporting Family Building Blocks, all nursery reliefs nurseries in Oregon. I'm very grateful, thankful.
Thank you for taking the time, and congratulations to you for what you've done. So,
How much time do we have left? Should we be?
You've used it for time, and go ahead.
Okay. For the record, my name is Sam Barber. I'm a lobbyist for the Association of Relief Nurseries. Thank you very, very much for having us, Chair Lively, and members of the committee. I just wanted to bring to your attention that we do have some legislation that Senator Winters has introduced for us. It's actually kind of in response to what you asked about, Representative Hack. I think, as Tim said, it is a difficult question where we belong. And because we lie at the intersection of healthcare and social services and early learning, but we've actually had a number of conversations with the Early Learning Division over the last few months, finishing today, this morning, just at noon, talking about this very issue and trying to make it work as best we possibly can. And the legislation is a piece of that. It seeks to clarify the statute around relief nurseries. So that legislative intent and our work and the ELD can all function as best it possibly can. We do have some changes coming to the legislation. An amendment is in the works that's going to change it quite a bit, so I won't go into details, but hopefully we'll be back with that soon. And currently it has a fiscal, so it would go to Ways and Means, but I think with the amendment that'll be changed, and so it's very likely that it'll come to your committee. And I look forward to chatting with each of you about that when the time comes.
Sure. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Hi, thank you. I have a question and then a couple of broad comments. How much did you get in state funding last year, and did it all come from the individual hubs? Do you apply to your hub to get the money, or do you have any line item in the state budget?
Yeah, so we have a line item in the state budget. We got $10.6 million in the last biennium. I believe it's funded directly through contracts with the ELD.
Exactly. And then we leveraged $16 million. From that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Can I ask a couple of
questions? Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. And do you know how much you have in the governor's budget and in the co-chair's budget?
Right. Yes. We are, I think it's, we should not be affected by it.
Both budgets have you steady at 10.6?
Exactly.
Both
yeah.
budgets. Okay. So my general comment is, first of all, I love relief nurseries. I have worked in the years past with Judge Pam Abernathy, who sounds very much like you. I've sat around a lot of tables with her, as well as in my own area, Judge Nan Waller, who are huge, just like you. They see the damage that's done and want to go upstream, and I really appreciate that. And I was involved with the North Portland Relief Nursery from early on. I had the great pleasure of serving with Representative Carla Peluso on the Multnomah County Commission on Children, Families, and Community. So we funded you. I was on the Portland Children's Levy. We funded you. I directed the Hannah Anderson Children's Foundation. We funded you. I love relief nurseries. And I had mixed feelings about the commission system being split apart. I think there were some county commissions that were very strong, and there were some that were not. And so I understand the reasons behind it. But definitely one of the reasons behind it was to really integrate services and to make sure that the services that we provided were child-centered. And we were really trying at the time, and you successfully fought this, as did CASA, to have money go through the early learning hubs so that the local decision-making could be done about the dollars following the child where they're needed. And so when Representative Hack talked about making sure you stay in the lane, we were actually trying to not have people stay in their lane, but to really break down the silos. So I understand what you were saying, and I would fight vigorously to keep the Children's Relief Nursery as part of the continuum. But the continuum, as you've said, is very different in every community. And I get that the hubs are still new, and some are working more effectively than others, just as the commission system did. So I don't have no idea what the legislation is that you're considering. I do know that DHS is an even larger bureaucracy than ELC. So sometimes grass looks greener on the other side. I chair Human Services and Housing, so I will be loving additional conversations with you. But I'm also very aware, and I appreciate in the previous slide, all the different integrated services that you do. You only have 6 hours directly a week with the children. You do a lot with parents. You do respite. I've been in your classrooms. I know you try to keep the low stimuli as possible because kids who have been abused can't take that. At least that was the model in North Portland. But the fact is you have very little direct contact with the children, and so where the children spend the rest of that time is critical. So the parenting education you do is very important, as is some of the other parenting education efforts that are out there, because you have limited time with those parents. Where the children are, whether it's with their families or in child care, there's so many other pieces of the system that we need to make sure are very strong. Child care, we don't want a 5x5 child care, which frankly is a lot of what the child care is, because it costs too much for us to provide quality, accessible child care. Prenatal care, all the things that create inflammation of the child going to the brain and the neurological development in the first 1,000 days. Toxic stress from not finding housing, not being able to get on job and to your job on time because transit's hard. Domestic violence, poverty, all of those things causes inflammation, which causes kids to have neurological, ADHD, a whole variety of things that put them at greater risk for child abuse. So all of these things are so integrated. The home visiting programs we want to support. I don't want to pit programs against each other, because the home visiting programs are the ones that would refer the higher at-risk kids to your kinds of programs. They're all really important. And so the challenge for us is, how do we adequately support them?
It's a systems question, and it's how you sort.
Yep, exactly.
And you need to sort based on the kids, and you need to sort on what their needs are. And the trouble is, when you get them in too many lanes, it doesn't become helpful to the family to be able to send people everywhere. So you can sort by what the needs are. I had the privilege of sitting on the Governor's Commission on Pregnant Substance Abusers, and we were trying to identify and build a system on the use of people who were using drugs, which was a ginormous problem just at the beginning, and now it's even worse. Mm-hmm. So they're complicated kids, and what you need to do is have them stable in a place where they're going to get all those services, and the families are going to be supported as they come in, and you need to be able to sort into different programs. But they can't stand the chaos. And I won't even start with the fact that I've been working with a major player on an app at a behavioral sciences, how to do interventions so that we can actually do better work, acute responsivity, because we were doing better work in the moment. Mm-hmm. But why the nursery even began is because people were going too many places, mm-hmm. and they couldn't sustain. So having it in one place, mm-hmm. and having each community have that array of services for their high-risk families that are wanting and asking mm-hmm. to get into services is a very different concept than going to a hub and then getting referred to someplace else. They come in and they're referred, then the nursery families are referred from pediatricians, from other family members, from everybody,
home visitors,
all over the place.
Right.
And so when they come in, it's a different approach.
Yeah.
As opposed to being sent in for this one piece, and so it's holistic.
Right.
And we forget that most people, whether it's in the criminal justice system or it's in early intervention, they cannot handle the chaos of a system that mm-hmm. doesn't recognize that. So you can deal with all those issues, but we have to design in a community. You know, what are the core principles that need to be there, and where can it be done in the fashion that allows the experts to be in one place and to get the families what they need?
Right. I totally agree, and I am so supportive of relief nurseries. I don't want any. This is the answer, as opposed to early Head Start, and people that need to cover more hours.
I was choking on saying DHS, because I really do think wanting a standalone,
yeah.
to be able to say this is, and then to build out from there, because it doesn't get down to the next legislative session, it doesn't get cannibalized. And that's my worry, is not to cannibalize a really evidence-based, fabulous program that the communities have embraced, and you have 31 nurseries because the communities, there was no leadership on this early on. It was the community saying we had to do better with our own kids and families, and we would step up and do that work. So it's complicated, I understand that.
So Representative Malmstrom.
Yes, thank you, Chair Lilly. I've been a public health nurse for the last 30 years in Multnomah County, and I had the privilege of working with all the different agencies that provide, you know, parent education. And I've always loved the relief nurseries. I always wish there was more of them. And the hard part for me was we'd have doing intakes of families and trying to match them with which programs were which. And it was through the relief nurseries, really way back, like in the 80s, when you were talking about, you know, adverse childhood events and the effect of that on children, long before all the other programs were so centered. And many of the other programs have been informed by this model about, you know, those issues of abuse and neglect. And to me, it's frustrating. Now, I realize it's different parts of the state, but in Multnomah County, where we have some of everything, it's really frustrating. It seemed like to me that there would be more people I would refer to the relief nurses, but there's capacity issues with every place. So it was kind of like we almost had to refer according to where the openings were, and we were this was the priority program for children that, you know, had really strong abuse and neglect. I mean, basically all these clients I saw did, but particularly there, because you weren't discriminating against some programs were only, you know, first-time parents, or they were, you know, they had to have OHP, or they had to have this or that or the other thing. But this program was so inclusive, and people really stayed in the program. All the home visiting programs had good records, but this particular one was so good because people finally found a place that they've truly felt safe. And I think it's really important that when we place people in one of these programs, they get to stay there, that it isn't jerked around. And at least in the Multnomah County ones that I worked with, the staff was pretty stable, and so they didn't have that revolving door. So I just think that's a wonderful thing. And kind of we're going back to what Representative Hack said, and how are you different? I see it as different as far as it's much more intensive regarding the knowledge of how to work with parents who desperately don't want to fall into the traps that they were raised in, and they want to learn a better way. And that takes a lot of time and modeling and really TLC to get there, and you guys do a really good job of that. So
it's a public health model in so many ways.
That's great. Thanks.
Did you have something?
Just one last. Yes. Thank you, Chair. I respect and the knowledge that you have is immense. When we talk about the lane, we do have a lane. It is different, and the service that you provide is different. And when you talk about the uniqueness of it, I think it is important, though, to look at where does that fit. And it isn't that I think we should operate on a silo or that we should go back to everybody being on islands. I am all about – I love the hubs, too. And I'm an advocate for them. I don't know what that looks like. And so that's why I think it's important that we have those tough discussions here. And that's kind of why I think this committee came together, was to bring these issues to the forefront, to say, you know, we had the Children and Families Commissions. We got rid of those. We're trying to figure out where all this comes together. Mm-hmm. But I also think that we have a responsibility to say that what the relief nurseries provide is unique, in that you deal with a special group of kids and families that may not fit into the rest of that. So how do we bring that together in a way that keeps you in your lane, but also is inclusive to the rest? So I just think that we have to be cautious about how we do that and how we move forward and figure out where all that comes together. So you have a wealth of knowledge, lady, and thank goodness you're here.
Yeah.
So,
wrap up. You don't want to lose the following. You don't want to lose at the end of the day. The nursery is probably the most important thing next to my kids that I've done in my life. I love my job, but this is more important to change the legacy of what we leave for the next generation. And we had long-time Oregonians, I'm just going to say long-time wealthy people who understood that they could contribute and be part of something and make a difference. So you had this incredible public-private partnership. And I'll never forget the day when we went out to have we have a board of stewards on the nursery, so it's wise elders who come talk to us about what we ought to be doing. And when we first started talking to those folks 30 years ago, they didn't think child abuse and neglect affected them. Now they know. You know, the timber industry, the misery index of crisis of families then deteriorate in the bad times, and we in Oregon go up and down. But I'll never forget the day that Robin Jaqua, John Jaqua's a widow at that time, Robin said, how's the building coming?
when we were out, we would visit her. She was in her 90s, and she was on the board of stewards, and she gave money every year, and she loved it. And we said, we're there. It's been a tough economy. Nancy Golden worked really hard to help us get the space in Springfield so that we would be between a school and this particular area of Springfield that desperately, desperately needed help. And having practiced law out there, I was well aware of it. And she said, well, how are you doing? And we said, well, we're doing pretty well. And she said, well, how come, how come you haven't asked me for money? Mm-hmm. And we said, well, because we're your friends, and I would never ask you for money. I have a job that doesn't let me do that, and I don't. And number two, you're a friend, and we would never do that. She goes, but what if I wanted to give you money? And we said, then, okay. So the next thing we knew, she wrote us $1 million check, $500,000 for the to have an endowment to encourage people to be part of continuing the nursery, and $500,000 on the building. I don't want us to lose that because we get too worried about power and control, let's just say, but we figure out how to leverage the goodwill of Oregonians and the goodwill of the community, because the only way our nurseries survive is that we are in the community all the time. And we are reaching out to bring people in, and what it's done for our community is it's actually heightened everybody's sense of belonging. Whether you have kids who are in need of services, or you just hang out, or you like some help, it has built a sense of community that it is really, truly my home, where I spend my social time, and where my kids were raised to give back. They only know that they are supposed to work at all these nursery events. That's how they were raised. So it's that sense of community that we're losing, and I think in so many ways, you have the chance to do something pretty special here. And take a look at all the issues. I welcome that. That's really important. So thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you all for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You bet. I'm going to close the informational hearing on relief nurseries. Open an informational hearing on child care subsidies. Somebody we haven't seen for a few minutes, David. But always welcome. So David, Kim, and Don.
Chair Lively, committee, for the record, David Mandel, Acting Early Learning System Director.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and members of the committee. My name is Kim Fredland, and I'm the Self-Sufficiency Director with the Department of Human Services.
Hi, Chair Lively and members of the committee. My name is Dawn Woods, and I'm the Child Care Director for the Early Learning Division.
Very good. Welcome.
Next slide. I'm like, you're talking.
We're really excited to have the three of us up together today, because I think we really want to talk about how the different pieces of child care fit together, both in terms of the lives of families, but also in terms of the work that we do as agencies. And I think really the point of departure for this conversation is the sort of the really crucial two-generational role that child care plays in families' lives. That safe, affordable, flexible child care is essential for parents to be able to participate and work and support their families. Child care, those experiences that children have in those settings are also really crucial to their development and have an impact on how they do in school and life later on. And I think the work that we do and the way that the Early Learning Division and DHS work together is in part about those two things.
I would just add, going back to that slide just for a half a second, I would just add that the mission of self-sufficiency is about the safety net for families, family stability, and then helping families connect to careers. And so childcare is the single largest expense for a family that is working and still in poverty. And if we hope to move families out of poverty, we have to be able to support them on that path. And so this is a program that's vital to that success of those individual families. And the collaboration with Early Learning Division so that we can make sure that the families are in the best possible setting while their parents are working, and the parent can focus on work, and the child can be supported in a positive way, is the best of both worlds.
So we thought the part of today would also be to, you know, this gets a little bit confusing, but just to help you also understand who does what and why. So the Early Learning Division through the Office of Child Care is responsible for licensing, ensuring health and safety of staff and children, for professional development of providers, and also for investments in quality, like SPARC, our quality rating improvement system.
So the employment-related daycare program is the program in self-sufficiency. It's a subsidy program that is for families that are working, and we support the payment of the child care through a co-payment system where the parent pays a portion, and it's based on their income. We also, one of the newer things since last full session, was the ability for families to also attend educational opportunities if they're working, and that we can help cover the cost of some of that child care while they're going to school, which is another, you know, vital service to helping families progress out of poverty.
So I want to kind of share just kind of an overview. And often, you know, we think about child care as, you know, helping families go to work. But really, it's also a consumer protection for parents. When a child care facility is licensed by the state of Oregon, the Early Learning Division, parents know that there are certain standards being met and that there's ongoing monitoring. And so I just kind of want to walk through some of the protections that we put in place to help ensure that children are in healthy, safe, and optimally developing programs. So one of the things that we do in terms of our license and compliance work is we conduct background checks on any individual who is working in a licensed facility or that lives in the home. So we license both large and small family child care, as well as then more, I think people think, typical center-based care. And so we do background checks on all of them. So for example, in a family child care, the husband would have a background check, any children over the age of 18. And they also, our background checks enroll them into a central background registry that actually is portable for the individual. So say you get a job in a different facility, your background check goes with you to that facility because they're all under our licensing. The other piece that we do is the on-site health and safety monitoring. So we have 7 field offices across the state where our licensing specialists are at, so that they can go out to the homes and the facilities to conduct both announced visits, which is typically the health and safety check, going through, doing the checklist, making sure the rules are being followed. But we also do an unannounced monitoring to check in again. And, you know, we really work for it to be a real supportive meeting, but we also are using it to ensure that the health and safety standards are being met. Additionally, we go out on any complaints that come into our office if they're of a regulatory nature. So if a parent isn't paying, that's not regulatory. We wouldn't go out on that visit. But if there was some concern about something being unsafe or a concerning individual in the home, we would go out and investigate and make a determination. And then if it's found valid, we would work with the provider to make that correction and issue that valid. The other piece that we do a lot of is public inquiries. So any parent or just community member can call and find out the full compliance history of a facility. So if a parent is looking for care and has called 211, and that's who does our child care referrals, as well as look at how to link them to other services that they may be interested in, they can also call us and get a full compliance history for that facility of all findings for as long as they've been licensed, essentially. So that's kind of how the consumer protection part of our work connects.
So who was doing that work before ELD?
So it was the child care division, which was a part of the employment department.
Okay.
Yeah. So a lot of what funds licensing and childcare is the Child Care Development Fund, or as we affectionately call it, CCDF. And so the Early Learning Division is the lead agency for that fund. So prior to the Early Learning Division, it was actually the Employment Department, Child Care Division was that lead agency. And much of what that work really looks at doing, the intent of the funds, I should say, is to really look at providing financial assistance to help working families, which is what employment-related daycare. That's a large portion, and David will actually share with you some of the dollars to kind of show how that plays out. We also use the dollars to fund to improve the quality and safety of childcare. And so that's going to look at, you know, the functionality of licensing, of, you know, what I just shared around consumer protection, but also really looking at how do we help our workforce that are caring for these children at this really critical point in their lives, of the professional development that they need, the support that they need to create enriching environments, and the support that they need just to ensure the health and safety in the home that they care for. So we fund the child care resource and referral system out of these dollars. SPARC, our quality rating improvement system, is done through this, as well as other professional development system supports. It's all kind of this package that we have to ensure that children are in good, healthy, safe places. Additionally, we work to have supports to increase the supply and availability of childcare. And this is really challenging to do, but it is definitely a part of kind of the delicate balance that we try to do within childcare licensing, of ensuring that children are in healthy and safe places, but that we're also supporting so that we have enough supply for families. And so that's kind of the intent of this CCDF fund. In 2014, CCDF was reauthorized, and this was like the first time in about 20 years that there had been any changes to this funding stream and the regulations, and there was really significant changes that really pushed to ensure health and safety, and I would say equally, it really pushed the that it's not just a workforce issue, it's also about children's development, and it's really equal. It's not one or the other, it's both and so I've kind of highlighted three of the big changes that we're currently implementing in the law. Last session we were able to do the 12-month eligibility in House Bill 2015, and so this is kind of some of the stuff that we're working on, and you see there's some House bills that actually connect that I believe we'll be chatting about later. So the first real significant advancement of reauthorization is on-site health and safety monitoring for license-exempt providers receiving subsidy. So prior to that, they were listed with DHS to receive the ERD subsidy. They weren't licensed by us, but now anyone who receives a subsidy, unless it's like a grandparent or a family, need to be monitored.
So how does a provider get to be licensed exempt?
If you care for less than three children, if you operate less than 4 hours, so there's kind of a list of exemptions.
Thank you.
And you can be exempt, but if you accept a child who's on subsidy, then we go out and do the monitoring.
Sure. You have just the other big category for licensed exempt is any facility that's under the auspices of a government entity.
Yeah. So
anything run by a school. Sure. Or if you guys wanted to open the child care facility in here, you would also be license exempt.
Okay, but still have to do the other. Okay.
The other real significant are enhanced background checks. So I talked a little bit about our background check process. Now they're enhanced. It's required for all individuals. So all the people that I talked about before to have FBI fingerprints, we check sex offender registries, child welfare records, and that wasn't something that was required prior to the passing of this federal law. Additionally, there are new consumer information sharing requirements, and a lot of that is around ensuring that there's an electronic way that families can go, or any individual can go and look at the
kind of a report of all of the inspections that have happened. So a real, it's all around transparency for families to make informed decisions and to understand what the compliance is. Yes, they can call us, but now we're required to post that on a website for families to be able to look at. And there's also some kind of other nuances, but that's the essence of what that requirement is.
But the background check is paid for from these funds, or are the people applying paying for it?
Right now, we have been able to subsidize a portion of it.
Okay.
I'm not sure where we're going to sit in the next biennium. And so we've been able to do a pretty substantial subsidy because it went from $3, which we were subsidizing. Now it's $35, which is substantial for this workforce, but that is not the true cost of what it takes. Okay. And so House Bill 2259 is really around our central background registry. And actually 2260 is within that same statute as well. And those are the bills that really allow us to meet these requirements. So 2259 really addresses us to be able to do the checks we need to do by federal law. And then 2260 allows us to provide that information to meet the federal law. So that's kind of how they connect.
Can you get it?
I couldn't find it on OLIS in 2014. These are Oregon bills, not federal bills, correct?
These are federal.
Okay, that's why.
This is the federal rule changes.
Yeah.
They have similar numbers than to ours.
No. These are new bills that will be coming to this.
Oh, I thought you were saying 2014. I was looking up those bills.
No, sorry.
Then to help us meet our federal requirements.
Right.
These are bills you've introduced this session.
You will be hearing about very soon. Okay. So we wanted to make sure that you understood the context for these bills before they came.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're on the topic of background checks, and you might be able to help me. I don't remember if we took care of it or not, but there was conversation. So it'd be nice if the relating clause would apply that we could take care of it here. Because of the cost to everybody for background checks, it was silly that every agency had to comply with the background check for the same person. Did we close that loophole, or can we close that loophole so that one background check in a 12-month period qualifies for all state agencies in need?
Chair, Representative Huffman, I know there's been some state-level conversation about this. It becomes quite challenging because what we can check for is defined in statute. So all background checks are not the same. We don't look at any... We are not authorized to look at any single kind of criminal activity. What we are authorized for, and I think for good reason, is to only look at activity that would cause the state concern about this adult having unsupervised care with children. So that's actually, that's part of the challenge in having one single background check, is because different folks have different authority to look at different kinds of information.
I remember those conversations, too, and I wasn't sure where we ended up. So.
I'm going to ask Representative Nathanson.
Okay, good.
Great.
Representative Bynum, do you have a question?
I just wanted to make the comment from the earlier presentation. I thought the judge's words about user-friendly, not agency-easy, were very important. And where we can find a way to be efficient, I'd support that. And so I want to say, how can we get to yes to make it easy for people to work? So that's my comment.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, everything that we've kind of, you know, that I've shared with you is kind of all part of a toolkit that we have of how we ensure the health and safety and well-being for young children. And I think the reauthorization of CCDF has really strengthened us being able to, you know, to do more to keep kids safe. But I know that we still have limits to what we're statutorily allowed to look at. And I mean, as someone who's there making the decisions, it's sometimes really hard when we have limits. And so I know that, you know, in future sessions, we'd be really interested in kind of working with this committee to see what is the right level of authority that we should have.
Sure. Thank you.
So first, I apologize because I stepped out for a bit.
That's okay.
I don't know what CCDF stands for.
CCDF is the Child Care Development Fund, so it's the block grant child care dollars that come from the feds.
Perfect, thank you.
Yep.
I won't remember, but thank you.
Yeah, none of us will either.
One way to think of it is about $140 million.
That's one way to think of it.
From the federal government.
Well, and that matches my salary, so I'll remember.
As you see from the slide, most of that money goes to direct subsidies for families. There's some that stays in the Division for Special Populations, but most of that 77% we transfer over to Department of Human Services for employment-related daycare. I also just wanted to make sure this committee is aware of, because of all of those changes in CCDF, those on-site health and safety monitoring that we are now required to do in order to receive this money. This budget cycle, we're asking to hold back a little bit more of CCDF than we would have in the past in order to be able to meet those federal requirements. So those federal requirements are resulting potentially in about $6.1 million less going into employment-related aid.
So in the presentation, is there some figures around how many families are served, or is that, do we know that? I assume we know it.
Yes.
But
yes.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you. I'll get there.
Okay. Thank
yes.
you. I assume that.
Part of it is I'm not, it's not, I'm a huge believer in employment-related daycare, so it's not the greatest thing to be withholding that money from.
No.
But I just want to be transparent about what's happening and why.
Thank you.
Great. Ready for Kim?
Yes.
All right. Great.
Hand it over.
Yeah. So, Chair Lively, members of the committee, again, my name is Kim Fredland with Department of Human Services, and we'll just flip right to our mission statement. I thought it was important to talk about our mission for a second, because we really serve three core responsibilities to Oregonians. One is we provide a safety net for families that are experiencing a financial or other kinds of crisis that bring them to us. And we really work to help the families become stable again, get back on their feet, and then connect them to the career path, because our mission is really about poverty reduction and helping families move out of poverty. And the employment-related daycare program is just really key to that mission, because when families are newly employed, especially younger families that have younger children, the cost of childcare is really high and would make it undoable for some families to go to work without this support.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, John.
While you have the mic, I just wanted to say, particularly the DALS staff are doing a great job. Deborah and Lori are at a lot of meetings that I am at. They're involved in a lot of different things, even trauma-informed care and sanctuary model and ACEs training and whatnot. So just wanted to do a shout out for them doing a good job.
Thank you very much, Rep. Huffman. That's great to hear, and I would concur with your assessment there. It's a great staff. Yeah. So just talking a little bit about poverty in general in Oregon, 60% of Oregon families are in poverty, and I'm sorry, children and parents compose 60% of the poverty in Oregon. So when, again, especially when children are younger, this is much more prevalent. Folks are newer into the workforce. They're not making as much money, or they haven't quite gotten into the workforce. In Oregon overall, the poverty rate of children hovers right around 20% overall, which to me seems shockingly high.
Which we know in a lot of rural parts of Oregon is much higher.
It is much higher, absolutely. So there was a lot of comments earlier in the prior informational hearing that this slide points to directly, that poverty and toxic stress really have a lot of impact on a child's development and really has long-lasting impacts for them. And, that looks like lack of school readiness and achievement as children, which widens as they grow older. When we think about adults, they're less likely to have steady employment. They're more likely to experience mental health issues. And so the situation that we're working with now is we're serving the parents who have been in poverty as children, who we're trying to help become successful, and we're also working to help the children not repeat that same cycle. And I think that that's where the really challenging piece comes in. I would say that certainly the employment-related daycare is more focused on the parent, but that's where that relationship with the Early Learning Division is really vital, because they have the expertise on the children's side. And there's a lot of new programs about helping both of those things come together, because both the parent and the child really need to be served. So just a little bit more about employment-related daycare itself. Because it's a subsidy program for low-income working parents, the money directly goes to support families that are working. And again, there's a subsidy that a co-payment that the parents make during that process. But the more their income goes up, the more that their co-payment is. One of the things that we looked at, just families in poverty, and as an example, a family, a mom and two kids, for example, needs to work full-time or more at $20 an hour or more in order to really leave poverty. And so we know that that's not the case for many families that we're working with. Their income is more part-time work. It's $10 an hour, $12 an hour. And so this is really key to that success.
Can I ask a quick question?
Certainly.
Thank you, Chair Lively. So when you say they need to hit the $20 mark in order to be successful, at what mark do they hit before they begin to lose some of their services? Is it $15 an hour, $12 an hour before they begin to start to lose?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, how the employment-related daycare program works is it's I would call it a sliding scale. And so the copayment starts at $27 is the lowest copayment. And then as their income goes up, depending on the amount of folks in the home, as their income goes up, then the child care copayment also goes up. So that the parent is responsible to pay their copayment first, and then the subsidy kicks in after that. So what happens for a lot of families is the copayment at some point will get to be beyond where their child care cost is.
Right. Can I have a follow-up?
Yes.
What I'm trying to get at is at what point, so is it at, so at $13 an hour, does their copay go up so high that they're really not receiving any more benefit? Is it at, so is there, maybe there's a way that we could actually look at, I'd love to look at the formulary to see where that is, because I'm just curious, at $13 an hour, are they off? Is it at, and
yes.
Who decides what that is?
So I would be happy to follow up with you. Because it's a formula that's got several pieces to it, it's not as easy to be able to say it's always, you know, $16 an hour or some
right.
other number. So I could be happy to meet with you and kind of walk through how that works.
That'd be great.
Do you mind if
yes,
I add something?
Please.
So, and I think part of it is the cliff effect that maybe, you know, we think a lot about. And part of House Bill 2015 last session also did the 12-month eligibility. And there's the where you can qualify for subsidy, but there's also a higher rate before you don't qualify, so that you don't have that cliff effect. Like, we heard a lot of stories of families mm-hmm. wouldn't take a quarter raise because they would lose their subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
So we extended when they're ineligible beyond the initial eligibility percent of FPL, federal poverty level.
Yes, FPL.
Yes. So I just.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, because I was just going to say, didn't we address the benefits cliff, because Governor Kitzhaber and I, it was a big discussion back in 2013, then a big discussion around the increase of the minimum wage, what would be the impact, but another question. So I teamed up, and probably some others up here, in 15 with the speaker to increase employment-related daycare. So where is the governor's recommended budget coming in and the co-chair's budget framework? Where are they at in regard to what we currently have invested for this biennium?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, the governor's budget fully funds the current service level for employment-related daycare, except for the holdback of the CCDF fund. So there will be a smaller amount of families that we can serve based on that. The co-chair's budget, I haven't been able to see exactly where the impacts and self-sufficiency are, because they were more broad buckets, and because we operate several different programs. I believe that the general fund is a smaller amount for ERDC going forward.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand, but there is a point on this formula, but there could be a point, even though their salary's gone up and they don't get a subsidy, they still can't afford on their own the cost of daycare.
Correct. Okay. So I think one other thing I want to highlight before we leave that slide is just, again, the importance of the 12-month eligibility time frame, where what that really helps with is if a family changes jobs and they have a break in employment for a couple of weeks or a month, that child care situation can stay stable and the same, whereas before that it used to close, and so then maybe there wouldn't be an opening at that provider anymore. So it's really a way to stabilize the children in the care. And the other thing is just, again, mentioning how important it is with the educational ability to cover some educational hours for the parent. So who we serve? So the average parent co-payment is $223 a month, and again, they start at $27 and go up based on the income. We are currently serving a little over 8,000 families, which is 15,000 children. The income has to be below 185% of the federal poverty level. Let's see. The current caseload cap based on the income or on the budget is 8,100 families. And we do have some capacity now where we're still bringing new families onto the program.
So just to clarify, so the $223 you talked about, that's the average copay that the families themselves pay per month?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Per child?
Sure, go ahead.
That would be for the family.
Right. Did you have a question?
She answered it.
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
Good job.
Did I not wait for that?
Thank goodness you're informal.
Okay, I think I'm... Okay. Sorry. So one of the things that was mentioned earlier is the change in regulations for the providers, which is a very good thing, and it's also created less. We believe that it has contributed to less providers available right now, based on January of 2016 versus this year, and so. The licensed providers, we've not seen a dramatic decrease. It's the license exempt providers, where the regulation increase has happened, where we've seen a reduction. And so we are hearing that across the state, that families are having a harder time finding childcare based on this. We do have some information on the numbers of providers taking advantage of the tiered reimbursement, which I'm hoping you can talk more about, but we have 188 38 star-rated providers who are currently serving DHS children in full-time care at this point. And in April 2016 to December of 2016, we had 1,900 children that were served by the higher quality rated providers.
Okay.
So just funding, we get most of the funds come from the federal government, but there is a 43% general fund investment in this program. And just kind of summarizing the program in general, based on the need that is in Oregon versus what we've been able to cover in 2012, the latest study that was done, the program was really only covering about 16% of families that would be eligible for the program. And so you can see that it is not covering the majority for certain. 16%. Yes, I did say 16%. So thank you for your time today.
Representative Kindergartner.
Quick question, thank you. So I've heard that foster kids are supposed to go first on the wait list for ERDC. But does that mean is that true? And does that still mean they have to wait until their openings? Foster families.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, right now there is no reservation list. The program is open and accepting children. So when the reservation list was in place, meaning that we had more children than we foster children and children leaving the TANF program due to new employment were two populations that we were still opening those cases and providing that service to families.
So they were top on the list when there was a waiting list?
So they were bypassing the list.
Mm.
Yes. They were, we were, if they were met all other eligibility, the case would be open.
And is the subsidy amount still the same for those families? We don't cover a greater share for foster families with kids in childcare?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
If we're only serving 16%, so help me understand why there isn't a waiting list or a reservation list or something.
It's a question that we've been asking ourselves, and based on some anecdotal information, what we believe that part of the issue is that because we've had a reservation list come on and go off and come on and go off, that we've not marketed maybe as well as we could have when we turned it. The ability to apply back on most recently. So we've been working to correct that.
Any other questions? Great. Anything else, David?
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Close the informational hearing on child care subsidies. Any other business for the committee?